Chapter 8. Talent Not Required. The night before the first long-distance triathlon in my life, I stood with my mother on the deck of a sprawling $7 million beach house in Kona, watching the moonlight play on the water. Most people know Kona, a gorgeous town on the west coast of the island of Hawaii, and triathlons in general, thanks to the Ironman World Championships. Although there are far more Olympic distance and shorter sprint triathlons held around the world than there are Ironman events, it was the original Ironman in Kona that placed the sport on the international radar. It starts with a 2.4-mile swim, followed by a 112-mile bike ride, and closes with a marathon run. Add to that stiff and shifting winds and blistering heat corridors reflected by harsh lava fields, and the race reduces most competitors to open blisters of raw anguish. But I wasn't here for that. I came to Kona to compete in a less celebrated form of even more intense masochism. I was there to compete for the title of Ultraman. Over the next 3 days, I would swim 6.2 miles, ride 261 miles, and run a double marathon, covering the entire perimeter of the Big Island of Hawaii. Once again, I was raising money for the Special Operations Warrior Foundation, and because I'd been written up and interviewed on camera after Badwater, I was invited by a multimillionaire I'd never met to stay in his absurd palace on the sand in the run-up to the Ultraman World Championships in November 2006. It was a generous gesture, but I was so focused on becoming the very best version of myself, his glitz didn't impress me. In my mind, I still hadn't achieved shit. If anything, staying in his house only inflated the chip on my shoulder. He would never have invited my wannabe thug ass to come chill with him in Kona luxury back in the day. He only reached out because I'd become somebody a rich guy like him wanted to know. Still, I appreciated being able to show my mom a better life, and whenever I was offered a taste, I invited her to experience it with me. She'd swallowed more pain than anyone I'd ever known, and I wanted to remind her that we'd climbed out of that gutter, while I kept my own gaze locked at sewer level. We didn't live in that $7-a-month place in Brazil anymore, but I was still paying rent on that motherfucker, and will be for the rest of my life. The race launched from the beach beside the pier in downtown Kona, the same start line as the Ironman World Championships, but there wasn't much of a crowd for our race. There were only 30 athletes in the entire field, compared to over 1,200 in the Ironman. It was such a small group I could look every one of my competitors in the eye and size them up, which is how I noticed the hardest man on the beach. I never did catch his name, but I'll always remember him, because he was in a wheelchair. Talk about heart. That man had a presence beyond his stature. He was fucking immense. Ever since I'd started up in Buds, I'd been in search of people like that. Men and women with an uncommon way of thinking. One thing that surprised me about military special operations was that some of the guys lived so mainstream. They weren't trying to push themselves every day of their lives, and I wanted to be around people who thought and trained uncommon 24/7, not just when duty called. That man had every excuse in the world to be at home, but he was ready to do one of the hardest stage races in the world, something 99.9% of the public wouldn't even consider, and with just his two arms. To me, he was what ultra racing was all about, and it's why after Badwater, I'd become hooked on this world. Talent wasn't required for this sport. It was all about heart and hard work, and it delivered relentless challenge after relentless challenge, always demanding more. But that doesn't mean I was well prepared for this race. I still didn't own a bike. I borrowed one 3 weeks earlier from another friend. It was a Griffin, an uber high-end bicycle, custom-made for my friend who was even bigger than I was. I borrowed his clip-in shoes, too, which were just shy of clown-sized. I filled the empty space with thick socks and compression tape and didn't take the time to learn bike mechanics before leaving for Kona. Changing tires, fixing chains and spokes, all the stuff I know how to do now, I hadn't learned yet. I just borrowed the bike and logged over 1,000 miles in the 3 weeks prior to Ultraman. I'd wake up at 4 a.m. and get 100-mile rides in before work. On weekends, I'd ride 125 miles, get off the bike and run a marathon. But I only did 6 training swims, just 2 in the open water. And in the ultra octagon, all your weaknesses are revealed. The 10-kilometer swim should have taken me about 2.5 hours to complete, but it took me over 3, and it hurt. I was dressed in a sleeveless wetsuit for buoyancy, but it was too tight under my arms, and within 30 minutes my armpits began to chafe. An hour later, the salty edge of my suit had become sandpaper that ripped my skin with every stroke. I switched from freestyle to side stroke and back again, desperate for comfort that never came. Every revolution of my arms cut my skin raw and bloody on both sides. Plus, the sea was choppy as hell. I drank seawater, my stomach flipped and flopped like a fish suffocating in fresh air, and I puked a half dozen times at least. Because of the pain, my poor mechanics, and the strong current, I swam a meandering line that stretched to 7.5 miles. All of that in order to clear what was supposed to be a 6.2-mile swim. My legs were jelly when I staggered to shore, and my vision rocked like a teeter-totter during an earthquake. I had to lie down, then crawl behind the bathrooms, where I vomited again. Other swimmers gathered in the transition area, hopped into their saddles, and pedaled off into the lava fields in a blink. We still had a 90-mile bike ride to knock off before the day was done, and they were getting after it while I was still on my knees. Right on time, those simple questions bubbled to the surface. Why the fuck am I even out here? I'm not a triathlete. I'm chafed to hell, sick as fuck, and the first part of the ride is all uphill. Why do you keep doing this to yourself, Goggins? I sounded like a whiny bitch, but I knew finding some comfort would help me hem my vagina, so I paid no attention to the other athletes who eased through their transition. I had to focus on getting my legs under me and slowing my spun-out mind. First, I got some food down, a little at a time. Then I treated the cuts under my arms. Most triathletes don't change their clothes. I did. I slipped on some comfortable bike shorts and a Lycra shirt, and 15 minutes later I was upright, in the saddle, and climbing into the lava fields. For the first 20 minutes I was still nauseous. I pedaled and puked, replenished my fluids, and puked again. Through it all I gave myself one job. Stay in the fight. Stay in it long enough to find a foothold. 10 miles later, as the road rose onto the shoulders of a giant volcano, and the incline increased, I shook off my sea legs and found momentum. Riders appeared ahead like bogeys on a radar, and I picked them off, one by one. Victory was a cure-all. Each time I passed another motherfucker, I got less and less sick. I was in 14th place when I saddled up, but by the time I approached the end of the 90-mile leg, there was only one man in front of me. Gary Wang, the favorite in the race. As I hammered toward the finish line, I could see a reporter and photographer from Triathlete magazine interviewing him. None of them expected to see my black ass, and they all watched me carefully. During the 4 months since Badwater, I'd often dreamt of being in a position to win an ultra race. And as I coasted past Gary and those reporters, I knew the moment had arrived. My expectations were intergalactic. The following morning, we lined up for the second stage, a 171-mile bike ride through the mountains and back toward the west coast. Gary Wang had a buddy in the race, Jeff Landauer, a.k.a. the Land Shark, and those two rode together. Gary had done the race before and knew the terrain. I didn't, and by mile 100, I was roughly 6 minutes off the lead. As usual, my mother and Kate were my two-headed support crew. They handed me replacement water bottles, packets of goo, and protein drinks from the side of the road, which I consumed in motion to keep my glycogen and electrolyte levels up. I'd become much more scientific about my nutrition since that Myoplex and Ritz cracker meltdown in San Diego. And with the biggest climb of the day looming into view, I needed to be ready to roar. On a bicycle, mountains produce pain, and pain was my business. As the road peaked in pitch, I put my head down and hammered as hard as I could. My lungs heaved until they were flipped inside out and back again. My heart was a pounding baseline. When I crested the pass, my mom pulled up alongside me and hollered, "David, you are 2 minutes off the lead." "Roger that." I curled into an aerodynamic crouch and shot downhill at over 40 miles per hour. My borrowed Griffin was equipped with aero bars, and I leaned over them, focusing only on the white dotted line and my perfect form. When the road leveled off, I went all out and kept my pace up around 27 miles per hour. I had a Land Shark and his buddy on an industrial-sized hook and was reeling them all the way in until my front tire blew. Before I had time to react, I was off the bike, somersaulting over the handlebars into space. I could see it happening in slow motion, but time sped back up when I crash-landed on my right side and my shoulder crumpled with blunt force. The side of my face skidded the asphalt until I stopped moving, and I rolled onto my back in shock. My mother slammed on her brakes, leapt from the car, and rushed over. I was bleeding in 5 places, but nothing felt broken, except my helmet, which was cracked in two, my sunglasses, which were shattered, and my bicycle. I'd run over a bolt that pierced the tire, tube, and rim. I didn't pay attention to my road rash, the pain in my shoulder, or the blood dribbling down my elbow and cheek. All I thought about was that bicycle. Once again, I was underprepared. I had no spare parts and didn't have any clue how to change a tube or a tire. I had rented a backup bicycle, which was in my mom's rental car, but it was a heavy, slow piece of shit compared to that Griffin. It didn't even have clip-in pedals. So I called for the official race mechanics to assess the Griffin. As we waited, seconds piled up into 20 precious minutes, and when mechanics arrived, they didn't have supplies to fix my front wheel either. So I hopped on my clunky backup and kept rolling. I tried not to think of bad luck and missed opportunities. I needed to finish strong and get myself within striking distance by the end of the day, because day 3 would bring a double marathon, and I was convinced that I was the best runner in the field. 16 miles from the finish line, the bike mechanic tracked me down. He'd repaired my Griffin. I switched out my hardware for the second time and made up 8 minutes on the leaders, finishing the day in third place, 22 minutes off the lead. I crafted a simple strategy for day 3. Go out hard and build up a fat cushion over Gary and the Landshark, so that when I hit the inevitable wall, I'd have enough distance to maintain the overall lead all the way to the finish line. In other words, I didn't have any strategy at all. I began my run at Boston Marathon qualifying pace. I pushed hard because I wanted my competitors to hear my splits and forfeit their souls as I built that big lead I'd anticipated. I knew I would blow up somewhere. That's ultra life. I just hoped it would happen late enough in the race that Gary and the Landshark would be content to race one another for second and give up all hope of winning the overall title. Didn't happen quite like that. At mile 35, I was already in agony and walking more than I was running. By mile 40, I watched both enemy vehicles pull up so their crew chiefs could peep my form. I was showing a ton of weakness, which gave Gary and the Landshark ammunition. The miles mounted too slowly. I hemorrhaged time. Luckily, by mile 45, Gary had blown up too, but the Landshark was rock solid, still on my ass, and I didn't have anything left to fight him off. Instead, as I suffered and staggered toward downtown Kona, my lead evaporated. In the end, the Landshark taught me a vital lesson. From day 1, he had run his own race. My early burst on day 3 didn't faze him. He welcomed it as the ill-conceived strategy that it was, focused on his own pace, waited me out, and took my soul. I was the first athlete to cross the finish line of the Ultraman that year, but as far as the clock was concerned, I was no champion. While I came in first place on the run, I lost the overall race by 10 minutes and took second place. The Landshark was crowned Ultraman. I watched him celebrate, knowing exactly how I'd wasted an opportunity to win. I'd lost my vantage point. I'd never evaluated the race strategically and didn't have any backstops in place. Backstops are a versatile tool that I employ in all facets of my life. I was lead navigator when I operated in Iraq with the SEAL teams, and backstop is a navigation term. It's the mark I made on my map, an alert that we'd missed a turn or veered off course. Let's say you're navigating through the woods and you have to go one click toward a ridgeline, then make a turn. In the military, we would do a map study ahead of time and mark that turn on our maps, and another point about 200 meters past that turn, and a third, an additional 150 meters past the second mark. Those last two marks are your backstops. Typically, I use terrain features, like roads, creeks, a giant cliff in the countryside, or landmark buildings in an urban setting, so that when we hit them, I knew we'd gone off course. That's what backstops are for, to tell you to turn around, reassess, and take an alternative route to accomplish the same mission. I never left our base in Iraq without having 3 exit strategies, a primary route and 2 others pinned to backstops we could fall back to if our main route became compromised. On day 3 of Ultraman, I tried to win with sheer will. I was all motor, no intellect. I didn't evaluate my condition, respect my opponent's heart, or manage the clock well enough. I had no primary strategy, let alone alternative avenues to victory, and therefore I had no idea where to employ backstops. In retrospect, I should have paid more attention to my own clock, and my backstop should have been placed on my split times. When I saw how fast I was running that first marathon, I should have been alarmed and eased off the gas. A slower first marathon may have left me with enough energy to drop the hammer once we were back in the lava fields on the Ironman course, heading toward the finish line. That's when you take someone's soul. at the end of the race, not at the beginning. I'd raced hard, but if I'd run smarter and handled the bike situation better, I would have given myself a better chance to win. You know, I got to ask you, one thing we don't say in this is you ran that double marathon that you're chastising yourself for with a fucked up shoulder and road rash.
Yeah, we don't talk about that too much.
I mean, it's not the first time you've run injured. Obviously, we've talked about broken legs, so it's actually not as bad as that. But what was going on physically there?
You know what? Honestly, I wasn't too bad of shape, even though I busted my ass pretty good when that bolt went through my front tire. But I handled that whole thing just jacked up, first of all. But here, I kind of thought I had the race won because I knew that the Land Shark, and I wasn't really worried about Gary Wang. He wasn't a great runner. But I knew I had the Land Shark dead to rights because why? He was a great ultra cyclist. And by this time, I had a lot of miles running under my legs. You know, I had a couple, you know, 200 or 300 mile races now, and I was ready to go. But like I said before in the last chapter, don't race anybody.
Right.
I then saw myself in position to win. After day two, even when I got off the bike, you know, and I caught, you know, I was like 20 minutes behind. They tried to fix the bike up. They got it fixed. I got on it and took off. I realized, man, I can kick this guy's ass in the 50 miler. That's how I was thinking.
Right.
That right there alone, I was setting myself up for failure. I'll set myself up for failure big time right there.
And part of it is if you were closer, if your bike situation, if you hadn't wrecked your bike and you were even with them, you probably wouldn't have felt that way of having to hammer the run so hard.
Right, exactly. So all those small, like, why the fuck didn't I just grab the bike in the, you know, literally there's probably every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, every month or so, I think about that situation like, wow, man, I could have won the Ultraman. I had a decent bike in the back of the car, and I sat there for 20 minutes because I wanted that Griffin fixed.
Interesting.
I mean, like, I'm like, just, you should have put your shoes on and just took the hell off. Hindsight being 20/20, man, but I just didn't do that. I just sat there and just overthought the process, and I ended up losing.
You thought maybe it would take too much energy to get the same miles?
You know what? I think I was thinking that, and I was thinking, man, this Griffin is fast.
Right.
You know, like the Griffin felt like a damn speed demon bike.
You felt like you were giving the power to the Griffin rather than it was you that pedaled it.
Right. You know, it was the Griffin. It wasn't me.
Right.
I wasn't controlling anything. But
right.
A funny story I'll share with you real quick while we're on the Ultraman and about to come off of it is, so I never talk about it hardly ever. And most people really think this is my first triathlon. And to me, it really is. But back around 1996, 1997, I was about 250 pounds, 260 pounds. I was still in the Air Force, and I have pictures of it at home. I was a big, big boy. And this buddy of mine was big time into doing triathlons. And he lived in Indiana, and my mom was still back in Indiana. So he's like, hey, let's do a triathlon. You can use one of my bikes. He had like 5 bikes. So I'm trying to, you know, try his bike out. And I'm realizing it's literally a 500-meter swim, a 10- or 12-mile bike, and a 3-mile run. So he has me try the bike out, and the seat hurt my ass so badly that I think I got about 3 to 5 towels and duct taped them to the seat, man. So it looked like some daggone Fred Sanford crap, man. It was hilarious.
Amazing. And you borrowed a bike for this one, too.
Yeah, this bike is very special to me here for the Ultraman. This Griffin came from a good friend of mine. His name is JT. I get kind of choked up about it just because of, he's now dead. He was a Navy SEAL. He was on DevGru. If you don't know what DevGru is, just Google DevGru and you can see exactly what DevGru is. And he died August 2011. He was killed in Afghanistan. And there's another sad thing about it is if you Google Navy SEAL dog at funeral, you will see one of the saddest videos, you know, to me of all time. This guy and his dog has such a special relationship that you'll literally see this dog laying by the casket the whole, you know, like just the whole time. It's, you know, it's truly remarkable how this dog just knew what was going on. And I can, you know, you can see the sadness within the dog. It's crazy.
But coming back into this part of your life, the Ultraman wasn't a disaster, and we're about to get into this next phase, and it really truly was the next phase of your life, both in the SEALs, but also as an athlete.
Yes, this is a very important part of my life here. I started even learning more about myself, my capabilities, and I just really start to even dig more and more and more into human potential, into, you know, limits of the human soul.
Still, coming in second place at Ultraman was no disaster. I raised good money for families in need and booked more positive ink for the SEALs in triathlete and competitor magazines. Navy brass took notice. One morning, I was called into a meeting with Admiral Ed Winters, a 2-star admiral and a top man at Naval Special Warfare Command. When you're an enlisted guy and hear an admiral wants a word, your ass sort of puckers up. He wasn't supposed to seek me out. There was a chain of command in place specifically to prevent conversations between rear admirals and enlisted men like me. Without any warning, that was all out the window, and I had a feeling it was my own fault. Thanks to the positive media I generated, I had received orders to join the recruitment division in 2007, and by the time I was ordered into the admiral's office, I'd done plenty of public speaking on behalf of the Navy SEALs. But I was different than most of the other recruiters. I didn't just parrot the Navy's script. I always included my own life story, off the cuff. As I waited outside the Admiral's office, I closed my eyes and flipped through memory files, searching for when and how I'd overstepped and embarrassed the SEALs. I was the picture of tension, sitting stiff and alert, sweating through my uniform when he opened the door to his office. "Goggins," he said. "Good to see you. Come on in." I opened my eyes, followed him inside, and stood straight as an arrow. Locked at attention. "Sit down," he said, with a smile, gesturing to a chair facing his desk. I sat, but maintained my posture and avoided all eye contact. Admiral Winters sized me up. He was in his late 50s, and though he appeared relaxed, he maintained perfect posture. To become an admiral is to rise through the ranks of tens of thousands. He'd been a SEAL since 1981 and was an operations officer at DEVGRU and a commander in Afghanistan and Iraq. At each stop, he stood taller than the rest and was among the strongest, smartest, shrewdest, and most charismatic men the Navy had ever seen. He also fit a certain standard. Admiral Winters was the ultimate insider, and I was as outside the box as you could get in the United States Navy. "Hey, relax," he said. "You aren't in any trouble. You're doing a great job in recruiting." He gestured to a file on his otherwise immaculate desk. It was filled with some of my clips. "You're representing us really well, but there's some men out there we need to do a better job of reaching out to, and I'm hoping you can help." That's when it finally hit me. A 2-star admiral needed my help. "The trouble we faced as an organization," he said, "was that we were terrible at recruiting African Americans into the SEAL teams." I knew that already. Black people made up only 1% of all special forces, even though we are 13% of the general population. I was just the 36th African-American ever to graduate, Buds. And one of the reasons for that was we weren't hitting the best places to recruit black men into the SEAL teams. And we didn't have the right recruiters either. The military likes to think of itself as a pure meritocracy. It isn't. Which is why for decades this issue was ignored. I called Admiral Winters recently, and he had this to say about the problem, which was originally flagged by the Pentagon during the second Bush administration and sent to the Admiral's desk to fix. "We were missing an opportunity to get great athletes into the teams and make the teams better," he said. "And we had places we needed to send people where, if they looked like me, they would be compromised." In Iraq, Admiral Winters made his name building elite counterterrorism forces. That's one of the primary missions in special forces, to train allied military units so they can control social cancers like terrorism and drug trafficking and maintain stability within borders. By 2007, Al-Qaeda had made inroads into Africa, allied with existing extremist networks, including Boko Haram and Al-Shabaab. And there was talk of building up counterterrorism forces in Somalia, Chad, Nigeria, Mali, Cameroon, Burkina Faso, and Niger. Our operations in Niger made international news in 2018 when 4 American Special Operations soldiers were killed in an ambush, drawing public scrutiny to the mission. But back in 2007, Almost nobody knew we were about to get involved in West Africa, or that we lacked the personnel to get it done. As I sat in his office, what I heard was the time had finally come when we needed black people in special forces, and our military leaders were clueless as to how to meet that need and entice more of us into the fold. It was all new information to me. I didn't know anything about the African threat. The only hostile terrain I knew about was in Afghanistan and Iraq. That is until Admiral Winters dropped a whole new detail on me, and the military's problem officially became my problem. "I'd report to my captain and the admiral," he said, "and hit the road, visiting 10 to 12 cities at a time, with a goal of spiking recruiting numbers in the people of color category. We made the first stop on this new mission together. It was at Howard University in Washington, D.C., probably the best-known historically black university in America. We dropped in to speak to the football team, and though I knew almost nothing about historically black colleges and universities, I knew students who attended them aren't usually the type to think of the military as an optimal career choice. Thanks to our country's history and the rampant racism that continues to this day, black political thought trends left of center at these institutions. And if you're recruiting for the Navy SEALs, there are definitely better choices than the Howard University practice field to find a willing ear. But this new focus required work in hostile territory, not mass enthusiasm. We were looking for one or two great men at each stop. The admiral and I walked onto the field, dressed in uniform, and I noted suspicion and disregard in the eyes of our audience. Admiral Winters had planned to introduce me, but our icy reception told me we had to go another way. "You were shy at first," Admiral Winters remembered, "but when it was time to speak, you looked at me and said, 'I got this, sir.'" I launched right into my life story. I told those athletes what I've already told you, and said we were looking for guys with heart, men who knew it was going to be hard tomorrow and the day after that, and welcomed every challenge. Men who wanted to become better athletes and smarter and more capable in all aspects of their life. We wanted guys who craved honor and purpose and were open-minded enough to face their deepest fears. "By the time you were done, you could have heard a pin drop," Admiral Winters recalled. From then on, I was given command of my own schedule and budget and leeway to operate, as long as I hit certain recruitment thresholds. I had to come up with my own material and knew that most people didn't think they could ever become a Navy SEAL, so I broadened the message. I wanted everyone who heard me out to know that even if they didn't walk in our direction, they could still become more than they ever dreamed. I made sure to cover my life in its entirety, so if anyone had any excuse, my story would void all that out. My main drive was to deliver hope that with or without the military, anybody could change their life, so long as they kept an open mind, abandoned the path of least resistance, and sought out the difficult and most challenging tasks they could find. I was mining for diamonds in the rough, like me. From 2007 to 2009, I was on the road for 250 days a year and spoke to 500,000 people at high schools and universities. I spoke at inner-city high schools in tough neighborhoods, at dozens of historically black colleges and universities, and at schools with all cultures, shapes, and shades well represented. I'd come a long way from fourth grade, when I couldn't stand up in front of a class of 20 kids and say my own name without stuttering. Teenagers are walking, talking bullshit detectors, but the kids who heard me speak bought into my message because everywhere I stopped, I also ran an ultra race and rolled my training runs and races into my overall recruitment strategy. I'd usually land in their town midweek, make my speeches, then run a race on Saturday and Sunday. In one stretch in 2007, I ran an ultra almost every weekend. There were 50-mile races, 100-kilometer races, 100-mile races, and longer ones, too. I was all about spreading the Navy SEAL legend that I loved and wanted to be true, and living our ethos. Essentially, I had two full-time jobs. My schedule was jammed full, and while I know that having the flexibility to manage my own time contributed to my ability to train for and compete on the ultra circuit, I still put in 50 hours a week at work, clocking in every day from about 7:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. My training hours came in addition to, not instead of, my work commitments. I appeared at upwards of 45 schools every month, and after each appearance, I had to file an after-action report, detailing how many separate events an auditorium speech, a workout, etc., I organized how many kids I spoke to and how many of those were actually interested. These after-action reports, or AARs, went directly to my captain and the admiral. I learned quickly that I was my own best prop. Sometimes I'd dress in a SEAL t-shirt with a trident on it, run 50 miles to a speaking engagement, and show up soaking wet. Or I would do push-ups for the first 5 minutes of my speech, or roll a pull-up bar out on stage and do pull-ups while I was talking. That's right. The shit you see me do on social media isn't new. I've been living this life for 11 years. Wherever I stopped, I invited the kids who were interested to come train with me before or after school, or crew on one of my ultra races. Word got out, and soon the media, local television, print, and radio, showed up, especially if I was running between cities to get to the next gig. I had to be articulate, well-groomed, and do well in the races I entered. I remember landing in Colorado the week of the legendary Leadville 100 trail race. The school year had just started, and on my first night in Denver, I mapped out the 5 schools on my roster in relation to the trails I wanted to hike and run. At each stop, I'd invite the kids to train with me, but warn them that my day started early. At 3 a.m., I would drive to a trailhead, meet up with all the students who dared to show, and by 4 a.m., we'd begin power hiking up one of Colorado's 58 summits above 14,000 feet. Then we'd sprint down the mountain to strengthen our quads. At 9 a.m., I'd hit another school, and then another. After the bell rang, I worked out with the football, track, or swim teams at the schools I visited, then ran back into the mountains to train until sunset. All of that to recruit stud athletes and acclimatize for the highest altitude ultramarathon in the world. The race started at 4 a.m. on a Saturday, departing from the city of Leadville, a working-class ski town with frontier roots, and traversing a network of beautiful and harsh Rocky Mountain trails that range from 9,200 feet to 12,600 feet in elevation. When I finished at 2 a.m. on Sunday, a teenager from Denver, who attended a school I'd visited a few days earlier, was waiting for me at the finish line. I didn't have a great race. I came in 14th place rather than my typical top 5. But I always made sure to finish strong. And when I sprinted home, he approached me with a wide smile and said, "I drove 2 hours just to see you finish." The lesson? You never know who you're affecting. My poor race results meant less than nothing to that young man, because I'd helped open his eyes to a new world of possibility and capability that he sensed within himself. He'd followed me from his high school auditorium to Leadville because he was looking for absolute proof, my finishing the race, that it was possible to transcend the typical and become more. And as I cooled down and toweled off, he asked me for tips so he could one day run all day and night through the mountains in his backyard. I have several stories like that. More than a dozen kids came out to pace and crew for me at the McNaughton Park Trail Race, 150-miler held outside of Peoria, Illinois. 24 students trained with me in Minot, North Dakota. Together we ran the frozen tundra before sunrise in January, when it was 20 below zero. Once I spoke at a school in a majority black neighborhood in Atlanta. And as I was leaving, a mother showed up with her 2 sons, who had long dreamed of becoming Navy SEALs, but kept it a secret because enlisting in the military wasn't considered cool in their neighborhood. When summer vacation broke out, I flew them to San Diego to live and train with me. I woke their asses up at 4 a.m. and beat them down on the beach like they were in a junior version of first phase. They did not enjoy themselves, but they learned the truth about what it takes to live the ethos. Wherever I went, whether the students were interested in a military career or not, they always asked if they had the same hardware I had. Could they run 100 miles in one day? What would it take to reach their full potential? This is what I'd tell them. Our culture has become hooked on the quick fix, the life hack, efficiency. Everyone is on the hunt for that simple action algorithm that nets maximum profit with the least amount of effort. There's no denying this attitude may get you some of the trappings of success, if you're lucky, but it will not lead to a callous mind or self-mastery. If you want to master the mind and remove your governor, you'll have to become addicted to hard work, because passion and obsession, even talent, are only useful tools if you have the work ethic to back them up. My work ethic is the single most important factor in all of my accomplishments. Everything else is secondary. And when it comes to hard work, whether in the gym or on the job, the 40% rule applies. To me, a 40-hour work week is a 40% effort. It may be satisfactory, but that's another word for mediocrity. Don't settle for a 40-hour work week. There are 168 hours in a week. That means you have the hours to put in that extra time at work without skimping on your exercise. It means streamlining your nutrition, spending quality time with your wife and kids. It means scheduling your life like you're on a 24-hour mission every single day. The number one excuse I hear from people as to why they don't work out as much as they want to is that they don't have time. Look, we all have work obligations. None of us wants to lose sleep. And you'll need time with the family, or they'll trip the fuck out. I get it. And if that's your situation, you must win the morning. When I was full-time with the SEALs, I maximized the dark hours before dawn. When my wife was sleeping, I would bang out a 6 to 10 mile run. My gear was all laid out the night before, my lunch was packed, and my work clothes were in my locker at work, where I'd shower before my day started at 7:30 a.m. On a typical day, I'd be out the door for my run just after 4 a.m., and back by 5:15 a.m. Since that wasn't enough for me, and because we only owned one car, I rode my bike. I finally got my own shit. 25 miles to work. I'd work from 7:30 a.m. to noon, and eat at my desk before or after my lunch break. During the lunch hour, I'd hit the gym, or do a 4 to 6 mile beach run, work the afternoon shift, and hop on my bike for the 25-mile ride home. By the time I was home at 7 p.m., I'd have run about 15 miles, rocked 50 miles on the bike, and put in a full day at the office. I was always home for dinner and in bed by 10 p.m., so I could do it all over again the next day. On Saturdays, I'd sleep in until 7 a.m., hit a 3-hour workout, and spend the rest of the weekend with Kate. If I didn't have a race, Sundays were my active recovery days. I'd do an easy ride at a low heart rate, keeping my pulse below 110 beats per minute to stimulate healthy blood flow. Maybe you think I'm a special case or an obsessive maniac. Fine, I won't argue with you. But what about my friend Mike? He's a big-time financial advisor in New York City. His job is high pressure, and his workday is a hell of a lot longer than 8 hours. He has a wife and 2 kids, and he's an ultra-runner. Here's how he does it. He wakes up at 4 a.m. every weekday, runs 60 to 90 minutes each morning while his family is still snoozing, rides a bike to work and back, and does a quick 30-minute treadmill run after he gets home. He goes out for longer runs on weekends, but he minimizes its impact on his family obligations. He's high-powered, wealthy as fuck, and could easily maintain his status quo with less effort and enjoy the sweet fruits of his labors. But he finds a way to stay hard, because his labors are his sweetest fruits. And he makes time to get it all in by minimizing the amount of bullshit clogging his schedule. His priorities are clear, and he remains dedicated to his priorities. I'm not talking about general priorities here, either. Each hour of his week is dedicated to a particular task, and when that hour shows up in real time, he focuses 100% on that task. That's how I do it, too, because that is the only way to minimize wasted hours. Evaluate your life in its totality. We all waste so much time doing meaningless bullshit. We burn hours on social media and watching television, which by the end of the year would add up to entire days and weeks if you tabulated time like you do your taxes. You should, because if you knew the truth, you'd deactivate your Facebook account stat and cut your cable. When you find yourself having frivolous conversations or becoming ensnared in activities that don't better you in any way, move the fuck on. For years, I've lived like a monk. I don't see or spend time with a lot of people. My circle is very tight. I post on social media once or twice a week, and I never check anybody else's feeds because I don't follow anyone. That's just me. I'm not saying you need to be that unforgiving, because you and I probably don't share the same goals. But I know you have goals too, and room for improvement, or you wouldn't be listening to my book. And I guarantee that if you audited your schedule, you'd find time for more work and less bullshit. It's up to you to find ways to eviscerate your bullshit. How much time do you spend at the dinner table talking about nothing after the meal is done? How many calls and texts do you send for no reason at all? Look at your whole life. List your obligations and tasks. Put a timestamp on them. How many hours are required to shop, eat, and clean? How much sleep do you need? What's your commute like? Can you make it there under your own power? Block everything into windows of time. And once your day is scheduled out, you'll know how much flexibility you have to exercise on a given day and how to maximize it. Perhaps you aren't looking to get fit, but have been dreaming of starting a business of your own, or have always wanted to learn a language or an instrument you're obsessed with. Fine. The same rule applies. Analyze your schedule, kill your empty habits, burn out the bullshit, and see what's left. Is it 1 hour per day? 3? Now maximize that shit. That means listing your prioritized tasks every hour of the day. You can even narrow it down to 15-minute windows. And don't forget to include backstops in your day-to-day schedule. Remember how I forgot to include backstops in my race plan at Ultraman? You need backstops in your day-to-day schedule, too. If one task bleeds into overtime, make sure you know it and begin to transition into your next prioritized task straight away. Use your smartphone for productivity hacks, not clickbait. Turn on your calendar alerts. Have those alarms set. If you audit your life, skip the bullshit, and use backstops, you'll find time to do everything you need and want to do. But remember that you also need rest, so schedule that in. Listen to your body. Sneak in those 10 to 20 minute power naps when necessary, and take one full rest day per week. If it's a rest day, truly allow your mind and body to relax. Turn your phone off. Keep the computer shut down. A rest day means you should be relaxed, hanging with friends or family, and eating and drinking well, so you can recharge and get back at it. It's not a day to lose yourself in technology or stay hunched at your desk in the form of a damn question mark. The whole point of the 24-hour mission is to keep up a championship pace, not for a season or a year, but for your entire life. That requires quality rest and recovery time, because there is no finish line. There is always more to learn, and you will always have weaknesses to strengthen if you want to become as hard as woodpecker lips, hard enough to hammer countless miles and finish that shit strong. David Goggins, there's a lot here to unpack, you know, from the eviscerating the bullshit to the way you schedule it. You want to talk about how you kind of came up with this, this approach?
Yeah. I mean, you know, in life, life gets in the way big time, and people use that, the unexpected. You know, you have a blowout going to work. Your wife or husband call you and say, hey, you got to pick the kid up. And we use all these things for excuses like, oh, man, now I can't go get my run in or get my studying in or whatever it may be. And that becomes, I have to change my whole schedule around so I can't get it in. That's just a good way of just giving you another excuse. You have to find a way to get it in. Like I said, there's 24 hours in a day. You have to use those backstops, you know, take a second and rethink what's going on. And this is another reason why this whole big thing now of accountability coaches, you know, people need them. Hmm. You know, people need these, people making a lot of money off of people's weaknesses.
There's accountability coaches? I've never heard of that.
Dude, you know what? I was watching some show with my fiance, and there is this reality TV show, and this girl makes money off of, you know, people's weaknesses, being an accountability coach. I mean, like, seriously, I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? So what, you need to call somebody? So you're going to call somebody that's probably not doing shit with their life. You know, I mean, seriously, think about all the shrinks out here in this world, man, who are listening to your problems, and then that shrink goes to see another shrink because they're crazy, you know, because they have problems. It's just, and you know, these accountability coaches are sitting back with a daggone ding dong, ho hos, you know, Mountain Dew on the phone talking to you about saying, hey, you need to get your ass up and go work out. You know, no, man, no, you got it all wrong. You're giving a lot of people money because you can't do these things. It's about getting up and making yourself uncomfortable. And pretty soon, all this stuff that you're reading or that you're listening to right now, it becomes a habit. It becomes a habit. The more you do and the more you do and the more you rewire your brain and say, oh, at first, yeah, this sucks. This is horrible. My God, this is a lot of stuff to do. Pretty soon it's like, hey, you know what? Roger that. Every day I go run. Every day I go to the gym. Every day I study. It's like breathing air. It's like breathing air. You know, no matter what goes on. So for instance, for me, if I know I have to be here at 4 o'clock in the morning to start, you know, reading this book and doing the audio, I know, hey, That means it's an hour to get here. I need to be up at 1:30 to get up, get my workout in, and then get there. It's not like, oh, I got to be there at 4 o'clock in the morning. That means, I can't get it in. That's how people think. So people think that the schedule dictates their day. No, no, no. The schedule only tells you how to schedule your day. Mm. That's what that is. So you got to rework all that stuff, man.
I love it. I mean, it's a great approach because when we first started to talk about this, I mean, 40-hour work week always to me sounded like, okay, that's fine. I mean, yes, I work more than 40 hours typically, but I never like look down on the 40-hour work week. But when you look at that compared to 168 hours a week, it does sound pretty flimsy.
Oh, and think about how much time you're wasting.
Yeah.
If you're spending 40 hours a week working, and it's 168 hours in a week, there's a lot of daggone fudge time in there, man. There's a lot of fudge time that we don't even look at, you know, so.
And even people at work, they're not working the full 40 straight anyway, usually.
Oh, no, not at all, man. There's so much time in there that they're bullshitting or whatever. And we're giving a lot of money to a lot of people to keep us accountable, which is crazy, man. Like, we need trainers. So we go hire like a, you know, for me to push myself, I'm going to hire a trainer to give me 20 workouts. But after that 20 workouts is done, what are you doing now? You know, are you back on the couch sitting down, chilling out? You know, you got to use all these things as starters to, you know, if you need a trainer, if you need an accountability coach, don't use it as a crutch. Use it as the kindling to start the fire. That's all it is.
I like the mechanics you set out here. I mean, this is very clear and it's easy for someone to really replicate more than some of the others, which are a little bit more, I guess subtle or they're open to interpretation. This one is pretty clear.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. You have to throw away all the bullshit, man. Eviscerate it.
Yeah. But you know, something you mentioned, just a couple of minutes ago, is the unexpected can sometimes descend. And sometimes that unexpected isn't just a flat tire. It's some chaos. And that'll kind of take over everything. And you have not been immune to that, as we know from your early life. But in this section, listeners are about to hear a whole new episode.
Oh, yeah. The unexpected is my best friend.
In 2008, I was back in Kona for the Ironman World Championships. I was in peak visibility mode for the Navy SEALs, and Commander Keith Davids, one of the best athletes I ever saw in the SEAL teams, and I were slated to do the race. The NBC Sports broadcast tracked our every move and turned our race within the race into a feature the announcers could cut to between clocking the main contenders. Our entrance was straight out of a Hollywood pitch meeting. While most athletes were deep into their pre-race rituals and getting psyched up for the longest day of their racing lives, we buzzed overhead in a C-130, jumped from 1,500 feet, and parachuted into the water, where we were scooped up by a Zodiac and motored to shore just 4 minutes before the gun. That was barely enough time for a blast of energy gel, a swig of water, and to change into our Navy SEAL triathlon suits. You know by now that I'm slow in the water, and David's destroyed my ass on the 2.4-mile swim. I'm just as strong as he is on a bicycle, but my lower back tightened up that day, and at the halfway point, I had to stop and stretch out. By the time I coasted into the transition area after a 112-mile bike ride, David's had 30 minutes on me, and early on in the marathon, I didn't do a great job of getting any of it back. My body was rebelling, and I had to walk those early miles, but I stayed in the fight, and at mile 10 found a rhythm and started clipping time. Somewhere ahead of me, David's blew up, and I inched closer. For a few miles, I could see him plodding in the distance, suffering in those lava fields, heat shimmering off the asphalt in sheets. I knew he wanted to beat me because he was a proud man. He was an officer, a great operator, and a stud athlete. I wanted to beat him, too. That's how Navy SEALs are wired, and I could have blown by him. But as I got closer, I told myself to humble up. I caught him with just over 2 miles to go. He looked at me with a mix of respect and hilarious exasperation. "Fucking Goggins," he said with a smile. We jumped into the water together, started the race together, and we were going to finish this thing together. We ran side by side for the final 2 miles, crossed the finish line, and hugged it out. It was terrific fucking television. Everything was going well in my life. My career was spit-shined and gleaming. I'd made a name for myself in the sports world, and I had plans to get back onto the battlefield like a Navy SEAL should. But sometimes, even when you are doing everything right in life, shit storms appear and multiply. Chaos can and will descend without warning, and when, not if, that happens, there won't be anything you can do to stop it. If you're fortunate, the issues or injuries are relatively minor, and when those incidents crop up, it's on you to adjust and stay after it. If you get injured or other complications arise that prevent you from working on your primary passion, refocus your energy elsewhere. The activities we pursue tend to be our strengths because it's fun to do what we're great at. Very few people enjoy working on their weaknesses. So if you're a terrific runner with a knee injury that will prevent you from running for 12 weeks, that is a great time to get into yoga, increasing your flexibility and your overall strength, which will make you a better and less injury-prone athlete. If you're a guitar player with a broken hand, sit down at the keys and use your one good hand to become a more versatile musician. The point is not to allow a setback to shatter our focus or our detours to dictate our mindset. Always be ready to adjust, recalibrate, and stay after it to become better, somehow. The sole reason I work out like I do isn't to prepare for and win ultra races. I don't have an athletic motive at all. It's to prepare my mind for life itself. Life will always be the most grueling endurance sport, and when you train hard, get uncomfortable, and callous your mind, you will become a more versatile competitor. Train to find a way forward, no matter what. Because there will be times when the shit life throws at you isn't minor at all. Sometimes life hits you dead in the fucking heart. My 2-year stint on recruitment detail was due to end in 2009. And while I enjoyed my time inspiring the next gen, I was looking forward to getting back out and operating in the field. But before I left my post, I planned one more big splash. I would ride a bicycle from the beach in San Diego to Annapolis, Maryland, in a legendary endurance road race, the Race Across America. The race was in June, so from January to May, I spent all my free time on the bike. I woke up at 4 a.m. and rode 110 miles before work, then rode 20 to 30 miles home at the end of a long work day. On weekends, I put in at least one 200-mile day and averaged over 700 miles per week. The race would take about 2 weeks to complete. There would be very little sleep involved, and I wanted to be ready for the greatest athletic challenge of my entire life. Then, in early May, everything capsized. Like a malfunctioning appliance, my heart went on the blink, almost overnight. For years, my resting pulse rate was in the 30s. Suddenly, it was in the 70s and 80s, and any activity would spike it until I verged on collapse. It was as if I'd sprung a leak, and all my energy had been sucked from my body. A simple 5-minute bike ride would set my heart racing to 150 beats per minute. It pounded uncontrollably during a short walk up a single flight of stairs. At first, I thought it was from overtraining, and when I went to the doctor, he agreed, but scheduled an echocardiogram for me at Balboa Hospital, just in case. When I went in for the test, the tech gelled up his all-knowing receiver and rolled it over my chest to get the angles he'd need while I lay on my left side, my head away from his monitor. He was a talker and kept bullshitting about a whole lot of nothing while he checked out all my chambers and valves. Everything looked solid, he said, until suddenly, 45 minutes into the procedure, this chatty motherfucker stopped talking. Instead of his voice, I heard a lot of clicking and zooming. Then he left the room and reappeared with another tech a few minutes later. They clicked, zoomed, and whispered, but didn't let me in on their big secret. When people in white coats are treating your heart as a puzzle to be solved right in front of you, it's hard not to think that you're probably pretty fucked up. Part of me wanted answers immediately, because I was scared as shit. But I didn't want to be a bitch and show my cards, so I opted to stay calm and let the professionals work. Within a few minutes, two other men walked into the room. One of them was a cardiologist. He took over the wand, rolled it on my chest, and peered into the monitor with one short nod. Then he patted me on the shoulder like I was his fucking intern and said, "Okay, let's talk." "You have an atrial septal defect," he said as we stood in the hallway. his techs and nurses pacing back and forth, disappearing into and reappearing from rooms on either side of us. I stared straight ahead and said nothing until he realized I had no idea what the fuck he was talking about. "You have a hole in your heart." He scrunched his forehead and stroked his chin. A pretty good size one, too. "Holes don't just open in your heart, do they?" "No, no," he said with a laugh. "You were born with it." He went on to explain that the hole was in the wall between my right and left atria, which was a problem because when you have a hole between the chambers in your heart, oxygenated blood mixes with the non-oxygenated blood. Oxygen is an essential element that every single one of our cells needs to survive. According to the doctor, I was only supplying about half of the necessary oxygen my muscles and organs needed for optimal performance. That leads to swelling in the feet and abdomen, heart palpitations, and occasional bouts of shortness of breath. It certainly explained the fatigue I'd been feeling recently. It also impacts the lungs, he said, because it floods the pulmonary blood vessels with more blood than they can handle, which makes it much more difficult to recover from overexertion and illness. I flashed back to all the issues I had recovering after contracting double pneumonia during my first hell week. The fluid I had in my lungs never fully receded. During subsequent hell weeks and after getting into ultras, I found myself hawking up phlegm during and after finishing races. Some nights there was so much fluid in me I couldn't sleep. I'd just sit up and spit phlegm into empty Gatorade bottles, wondering when that boring ritual would play itself out. Most people, when they become ultra-obsessed, may deal with overuse injuries, but their cardiovascular system is finely tuned. Even though I was able to compete and accomplish so much with my broken body, I never felt that great. I'd learned to endure and overcome, and as the doctor continued to download the essentials, I realized for the first time in my entire life I'd also been pretty fucking lucky. You know, the backhanded brand of luck, where you have a hole in your heart, but are thanking God that it hasn't killed you yet. Because when you have an ASD like mine, and you dive deep underwater, gas bubbles, which are supposed to travel through the pulmonary blood vessels to be filtered through the lungs, might leak from that hole upon ascent and recirculate as weaponized embolisms that can clog blood vessels in the brain and lead to a stroke, or block an artery to the heart and cause cardiac arrest. It's like diving with a dirty bomb floating inside you, never knowing when or where it might go off. I wasn't alone in this fight. 1 out of every 10 children are born with the same defect. But in most cases, the hole closes on its own, and surgery isn't required. In just under 2,000 American children each year, surgery is required, but is usually administered before a patient starts school, because there are better screening processes these days. Most people my age who are born with ASD left the hospital in their mother's arms and lived with a potential deadly problem without a clue, until, like me, their heart started giving them trouble in their 30s. If I had ignored my warning signs, I could have dropped dead during a 4-mile run. That's why, if you're in the military and are diagnosed with an ASD, you can't jump out of airplanes or scuba dive. And if anyone had known of my condition, there is no way the Navy ever would have let me become a SEAL. It's astonishing I even made it through Hell Week, Badwater, or any of those other races. I'm truly amazed you could do all you've done with this condition, the doctor said. I nodded. He thought I was a medical marvel, some kind of outlier, or simply a gifted athlete blessed with amazing luck. To me, it was just further evidence that I didn't owe my accomplishments to God-given talent or great genetics. I had a fucking hole in my heart. I was running on a tank perpetually half full, and that meant my life was absolute proof of what's possible when someone dedicates themselves to harnessing the full power of the human mind. 3 days later, I was in surgery. And boy, did the doctor fuck that one up. First off, the anesthesia didn't take all the way, which meant I was half awake as the surgeon sliced through my inner thigh, inserted a catheter into my femoral artery, and once it reached my heart, deployed a helix patch through that catheter and moved it into place, supposedly patching the hole in my heart. Meanwhile, they had a camera down my throat, which I could feel as I gagged and struggled to endure the 2-hour-long procedure. After all of that, my troubles were supposed to have been over. The doctor mentioned that it would take time for my heart tissue to grow round and seal the patch, but after a week, he cleared me for light exercise. Roger that, I thought, as I dropped to the floor to do a set of push-ups as soon as I got home. Almost immediately, my heart went into atrial fibrillation, also known as AFib. My pulse spiked from 120 to 230, back to 120, then up to 250. I felt dizzy and had to sit down as I stared at my heart rate monitor while my breathing normalized. Once again, my resting heart rate was in the 80s. In other words, nothing had changed. I called the cardiologist, who tagged it as a minor side effect, and begged patience. I took him at his word and rested for a few more days, then hopped on the bike for an easy ride home from work. At first, all went well, but after about 15 miles, my heart went into AFib once again. My pulse rate bounced from 120 to 230 and back again across the imaginary graph in my mind's eye with no rhythm whatsoever. Kate drove me straight to Balboa Hospital. After that visit and second and third opinions, it was clear that the patch had either failed or was insufficient to cover the entire hole and that I'd need a second heart surgery. The Navy didn't want any part of that. They feared further complications and suggested I scale back my lifestyle, accept my new normal, and a retirement package. Yeah, right. Instead, I found a better doctor at Balboa who said we'd have to wait several months before we could even contemplate another heart surgery. In the meantime, I couldn't jump or dive and obviously couldn't operate in the field, so I stayed in recruitment. It was a different life, no doubt, and I was tempted to feel sorry for myself. After all, this thing that hit me out of the clear blue changed the entire landscape of my military career. But I'd been training for life, not ultra races, and I refused to hang my head. I knew that if I maintained a victim's mentality, I wouldn't get anything at all out of a fucked up situation, and I didn't want to sit home defeated all day long. So I used the time to perfect my recruitment presentation. I wrote up sterling AARs and became much more detail-oriented in my administrative work. Does that sound boring to you? Fuck yes, it was boring. But it was honest, necessary work, and I used it to keep my mind sharp for when the moment came that I'd be able to drop back into the fight for real. Or so I hoped. A full 14 months after the first surgery, I was once again rolling through a hospital corridor, on my back, staring at the fluorescent lights in the ceiling, headed to pre-op with no guarantees. While the techs and nurses shaved me down and prepped me up, I thought about all I'd accomplished in the military and wondered, was it enough? If the docs couldn't fix me this time, would I be willing to retire, satisfied? That question lingered in my head until the anesthesiologist placed an oxygen mask over my face and counted down softly in my ear. Just before lights out, I heard the answer erupt from the abyss of my jet-black soul. Fuck no! There's so much to unpack here, but I'm going to start with a simple question.
Yes, sir.
Which is, your resting heart rate in the 30s?
Yeah, it was sick, man. I had trained so much. So, as you know, I did a bunch of heart rate training. So I was really big into zone training. So I did 80 to 90% of my runs at a zone 2. So there's like 5 zones. Zone 5 being like Usain Bolt, where you're trying to run a 100-yard dash. That's as fast as you can go. So zone 1, so that's zone 5, fast as you can go. Zone 1 is like that recovery thing I would do on Sunday sometimes. I would sit on the bike and I would spin real low at like a 90 to 110 heart rate. That's recovery. Zone 2 was my literally, that's where I would do all the fat burning.
Right.
And that was my all day zone. And that trained my heart.
Is that like orange or is that yellow?
I'm not for sure exactly what color
it's
that
different,
is.
It's different now,
yep,
right?
It's different colors. Okay. So for me though, I just knew that was like between like a 140 and 150 heart rate. And I would do that all the time, but for hours and hours a day. So it got my actual like resting heart rate down to the 30s.
It's amazing because, you know, most like people who, I guess, work weekend warriors who are at least working out 4 times a week or something can be in the 60s, right?
Right.
And then athletes, professional athletes tend to be 40s and 50s, right?
Right.
But 30s is pretty low.
Oh yeah. 30s is real low, man. Like,
that's like some Yoda shit, bro.
Yeah, that's some Yoda shit. Well, I put some Yoda time in, man, but there was no Jedi force. It was Goggins force.
That's it. Anything you want to say? I mean, we cover it pretty well. I don't know if you want to underline anything about that period in your life.
Well, one big thing here that kept me going is I kept on, and there's a lot more challenges to come. I mean, we're just 8 chapters in, and what's funny is every chapter there's a new challenge for me, a new big hurdle to overcome. And like I said before, you know, obstacles in your life, you need friction to grow. And those obstacles are friction. And that's how I started looking at everything in life. It's how you look at the obstacles in your life versus like, woe is me. You know, my life sucks. God, why me? Why me? Why me? My mentality was like, hey, man, you know what? If I can get through this, I'm even harder than I was before. You know, like the more I got hit, the harder I got hit, the more I was like, okay, man, you know what? Yeah, I would get sad. You know, you wouldn't have fucking heart surgery. I mean, it was killing, but like, hey, man, you're going to have heart surgery regardless. It is yours to own. I can approach it two ways. Either like all negative, man, my life sucks, woe is me. Or, hey, man, I'm having heart surgery. Let's see how fast I can get better. Let's see this. Let's see that. Let's have a great attitude. And another thing that kept me going was back in the day, I always thought growing up, I was the weakest man that God ever created. And my whole goal in life, you know, I wanted to, you know, see these uncommon men and work with them and do all these hard things and overcome all these obstacles. But my goal was to be the hardest man that God ever created. And that whole thing, you know, it wasn't about being a SEAL. It wasn't about being, you know, about being a Ranger and all these other things I did in my life. It was strictly about when these times came up, like, hey, Goggins, you're going to have heart surgery. How do you attack that? That's what me, you know, that's what hardness means to me. All the obstacles in your life, it's not about running fast or being some guy who can handle cold water. How do you handle what life throws at you? And I realized that's what I want to do good at. That's what I want to be an all-star at. And that's, you know, this was another time for me to say, okay, man, this is your second heart surgery. How are you going to handle it?
Well, there's no doubt you're an all-star at it. I mean, and I think we have to go back to childhood where you did have the time where you were in the woe is me.
Right.
You did live in woe is me in times. And it doesn't mean that you didn't have you know, some parts of your childhood that you loved. You had your friends, you had your popularity, you played ball.
Yep.
But you also had a lot of woe is me and you felt it. And then you fix that.
Right.
And then you fell back into it. And then you fix it again. And I always say, you know, to me, life is reps, right?
It takes reps.
And you got those reps in early. And that, I think, you have had to contribute to your attitude here.
Well, the thing about all those, you know, all those friends and all those good times and all that crap. Yeah, it's true. I had them. But the one thing our mind does is that we focus on the one small thing we don't have. You know, we can have a great life, great wife, great husband, beautiful home, all this shit. But I have this one small thing in my life that's not so great. And that's what you focus on. And that's what I learned that I was doing. I was like, my God, man, my life isn't that bad. But I focused on that one kid at school who called me a nigger. The one kid at school, not the whole school. The one kid that was beating me down, that was my reality. Oh, my God, everybody hates me. That's not the truth, man. It's not the truth. So I first had to find out the truth. I didn't see that. Then I had to realize this. I was a weak kid. My life had made me a very fragile, insecure, weak person. And in realizing that, I wanted to master my fears. I wanted to become a master of my fears. So many of us that are afraid of something, we just shy away from it. The best way to overcome anything in life is to become a master of what you're afraid of. Become a master of your insecurities. Become a master of all that stuff. Learn about it. A lot of times you just don't know what the hell you're afraid of.
Well, it's like you've been saying all along, it's yours to own.
That's
and
right.
And once you own it and own the inevitability of the heart surgery, you can then spin it and use it in some way to grow.
Exactly, man. A lot of this stuff in your life that's happening to you, it's not going away. It's not going to go away. So you better go ahead and face it head on.
Beautiful. All right, let's get into the challenge 8. And we know what it is. We talked about it in this chapter. Challenge 8. Schedule it in. It's time to compartmentalize your day. Too many of us have become multitaskers, and that's created a nation of half-asses. This will be a 3-week challenge. During week 1, go about your normal schedule, but take notes. When do you work? Are you working nonstop or checking your phone? The Moment app will tell you. How long are your meal breaks? When do you exercise, watch TV, or chat to friends? How long is your commute? Are you driving? I want you to get super detailed and document it all with timestamps. This will be your baseline, and you'll find plenty of fat to trim. Most people waste 4 to 5 hours on a given day, and if you can learn to identify and utilize it, you'll be on your way toward increased productivity. In week 2, build an optimal schedule. Lock everything into place in 15 to 30 minute blocks. Some tasks will take multiple blocks or entire days. Fine. When you work, only work on one thing at a time. Think about the task in front of you and pursue it relentlessly. When it comes time for the next task on your schedule, place that first one aside and apply the same focus. Make sure your meal breaks are adequate, but not open-ended. And schedule in exercise and rest too. But when it's time to rest, actually rest. No checking email or bullshitting on social media. If you are going to work hard, you must also rest your brain. Make notes with timestamps in week 2. You may still find some residual dead space. By week 3, you should have a working schedule that maximizes your effort without sacrificing sleep. Post photos of your schedule with the hashtags #can't hurt me, #talent not required.